point is, though he was involved with idolatry and everything, he still made his way across the Jordan with the Jewish people.
Yeah.
To take on their,
I guess,
their loss.
Yeah. Yes, he did. And for 28 years under Yahushua, yeah. So,
was there a lot of that?
That's, I think, the indication. I think that's what we're supposed to draw on from the from the psukim.
Yeah. Not everyone believers, but they followed and they just went.
Well, not that it was like that necessarily when they came in under Yahushua. Under Yahushua, we have no indication of Avodah Zarah at all, of idolatry at all. It's, things come off the rails after Yahushua.
Like 30 years
but something's correct. But something is clearly building here. Something is clearly starting here. And things weren't, even if they didn't explode in Yahushua's time, something had to have been germinating along the way. But I want to now shift gears to introduce the next story, the last story in the book. And this is the disaster of all disasters. This is the worst of the worst. You will not see an uglier story in Tanakh, which is saying something. But you will not. There just isn't. This 19. It's, and these are the last three prakim, the last three chapters of Shoftim are this story. I realize I'm giving you a lot of incentive to keep coming back. But this is a story in which all of this, everything we've seen, the syncretism, the greed, the whole bit, just becomes much, much worse. The Jewish people is basically eating itself alive at this point. If you take a look at source number 3, I just gave you a quick outline of the psukim. So it's going to start out with a prologue, a story about a Levi, his Pilegesh, I'll come back to what a Pilegesh is, and her family. It will continue with an atrocity that occurs in a Jewish city called Giv'ah. There will be national horror in response to this atrocity, and ultimately they're going to go to war with the tribe of Binyamin, which is where Giv'ah is, and Binyamin will end up killing many Jews who are not from Binyamin. The other Jews are going to kill many from Binyamin. There will be an oath taken that nobody may marry into the tribe of Binyamin. No woman may marry a male from Binyamin, and then there will be the problem of this Shevet is going to disappear. The tribe is going to disappear. We need to do something, and their solution for the problem is itself a problem. This is just a devastating story all around. There are no good people in this story. There are no heroes in this story. There are no nice people in this story. Going back, though, into just where this story is located in the book, like Pesel Micha, the previous story, this is dislocated from its original time. The story is believed to have occurred much earlier on. And the factors for backdating this story include the following. First of all, Ralbag, and he did this with the story of Micha as well, he says there isn't enough time. Meaning we know how many years elapsed from the death of Yahushua until the time of Shmuel. And we have all along, this Shofet was there for this number of years and this number of years, and you can construct a timeline. And after Shimshon's time, before Eli and Shmuel, there isn't enough time for this story to take place. And that's one reason why you say this story must have occurred earlier. Barbanel is not impressed. But that's Ralbag's approach. Second, we're going to emphasize here in the story, as we emphasized in the story of Micha's idol, the Ein Melech B'Yisrael. There is no king in Israel, which we take to mean no king and no shofet, no judge, which suggests it's from an earlier time. Rashi adds a note. If you take a look at source number 4, they're going to talk about a city called Yevus. Ubehilegish begivah ne'emar, source number 4. Ubehilegish begivah ne'emar al Yevus, Shebirushalayim, lo nasur el iro de kochavim. The Levi, his Pilegesh, and their family, the Levi and the Pilegesh are traveling, and they need a place to stop for the night. And they say, let's go to Yevus. And then the Levi says, well, I don't want to go to Yevus, because it's a city of idolaters. So Rashi says, well, during the period of the Shoftim, that city was conquered, he says. So Lamanu Shadayin Lo Kavshu Es Yerushalayim. We learned they had not yet conquered Jerusalem when this story happened, so it must be earlier on. And then finally, the Dan Mikra edition points out, we are going to see our favorite person in all of Yahushua and Shoftim show up again in the story, and that is Pinchas. Pinchas will be back again. Now, if you say, we've talked about before the question of when Pinchas died, and we noted there's a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim which talks about the Kohanim in the time of David, and it mentions Pinchas. And the question is, does it mean it's saying that Pinchas is actually still around then, or is it a retrospective sentence? These were Kohanim who served. That mikra is of the view that that sentence in Divrei Hayamim is not saying Pinchas is alive then. It's saying Pinchas had been a Kohen at one point, and certainly he'd be very, very old by now. By this stage, if this story occurred at the end of the period of the Shoftim, he would literally be centuries old, right? He would be, I think, somewhere around 400 years old. Unless you say the story happened, again, in the beginning of the period of the Shoftim, in which case it's fine. Yeah, but just 30 years before that, he was, he was killing Zimri. You know, it's not as though it's beyond the pale of all. He was active at the end of Yoshua, right? He led the Jews when they thought that Reuven and Gad and Menashe were forming the breakaway temple. So those are reasons why this story tends to be assumed. We tend to assume this story is in the beginning, not at the end of the period of the Shoftim. Of course, once again, Abarbanel and Radak do say, no, we think this story happened here. Question. If the story happened earlier, why do you put it at the end of the book of Shoftim? So one answer is that you want to, as I said to Ricky in the beginning, right, the goal is to show the depths we reached and why we need a king. And this story really shows it. Also, this story highlights the moral downturn of the Jews. Take a look at source number 5. Mibnei malo manu es micha. When they talk about the Mishnah in the beginning of the last chapter in Sanhedrin, talks about who doesn't make it into Olam Haba, who doesn't make it into the next world. And they don't list Micha. Micha is not on that list. Why don't they list Micha? Mibnesha pitom mitsuyala ovrei drachim. Because at least his bread was available for travelers, right? Meaning the lady came through the area and needed a place to stay, and Micha welcomed him in. The people of Dan, the initial 5-man group, came through. Sure, stay with me. So he at least was hospitable. Bikshu malachei asherez ledochvo. The Malachim wanted to push him. They wanted to say, no, he doesn't belong in Olam Haba. He doesn't get the next world. And Amar Lena Kadosh Baruch Hu, but God said to them, no. Hanichu lo, leave him be. Shepito Mitzuyala Ovrei Drachim. At least his bread is available for travelers. V'al Davar Zeh Ne'enshu Anshei Pilagish Begiva, which they don't have in Pilagish Begiva. Just the opposite. In our story of this, of what's going to happen here, the Pilagish in Giva, we will find the opposite. We will find stone-like behavior in which they do not offer hospitality. So that's another reason why this story is at the end, is to show just how far we sunk in idolatry as well as in the way we deal with each other. Abarbanel offers another explanation for why this is at the end, and that's why I brought you in number 6. He says, V'achrei zichronam siper anyanim ha'ele. After listing those other events, it then talked about these two stories. V'im hayosam kodmim bizman hayu achronim basefer. He says, if you take the view that they actually occurred earlier, which is not his own view, but he says, taking the view that they occurred earlier, they're last in the book. L'fisha nizkru yachad inyanei ha-shoftim u'mechamoseihem. V'achrei ha-shlamasam zachar inyanei Yisrael shakaru b'mehem she'inu misyachsim al ha'oivim v'la shoftim. He says, the first part of the book gave me all about the Jews and their enemies, and the judges who led us and saved us from our enemies. These two stories, the idol of Micha, and the Pilegish Begiva story, these stories don't involve enemies. It's all Jews against Jews. There are no other nations involved in this, and there's no shofet. So they're really a thing unto themselves. They don't belong in the rest of the book. And that's another explanation. Plus, there are certain common elements between these two stories of Micha's idol and this story, as we'll see. The shared traits of these stories. Well, first of all, the idol of Micha, that Pesal Micha story, a Levi came from Yehuda to Ephraim. Here we're going to see a Levi go from Ephraim to Yehuda. So, some interesting features that are joint. The major joint feature is the explicit message of the lack of leadership. It's going to repeat yet again for us the Melech Ein B'Yisrael, right at the start of the story in Perek Yotet Pasuk Aleph, Vayibay Memahem, Melech Ein B'Yisrael in 19:1. It was in those days. There was no king in Israel, and it will be repeated at the very end of the story. right? The last sentence in Shoftim, not to blow the ending, Bayamim ahem ein melech b'Yisrael. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Ish hayashar beinav yaaseh, and each one just did whatever he thought made sense. The warped nature of people's Judaism is going to be seen here. You have a house of idolatry to worship God, right? That's what you saw in Pesel Micha. And here you will see the defense of guests via the abuse of one's children and the defense of righteousness. I don't want to give you too much of the story already. But the defense of righteousness by dismembering a body, as you will see. And finally, the corruption of an entire tribe. First it was Dan, and now it is Binyamin. So all of this is joint between these stories. Actually, there's more to be said, but let me leave it at that. Fundamentally, both stories detail decline in the way we deal with each other, decline in the way we deal with God. The difference between the two stories is just that the Pesel Micha story, the story of Micha's idol, is really told with a tone of ridicule. It's like, look at these people, aren't they funny? Right? Isn't this weird, this Levi who just goes from place to place? And that Micha says, the God I made, hey, you stole the God I made, and things like that. There's a certain sense of humor as you read that, like, these people are weird. As opposed to, in this story, there is no humor. There is nothing funny going on in this story whatsoever. Two other notes of preface that we need to talk about. First of all, this story is going to pit Binyamin against everybody else, but primarily against Yehuda. Yehuda is going to lead the war against Binyamin. So here's my question to you. When else have we seen the possibility of such a conflict between Yehuda and Binyamin?
David and Shaul.
First king of Israel is Shaul from Binyamin. And then the one after him is David from Yehuda. So some have tried to suggest, particularly among the Bible scholars, that this is actually a polemic against Shaul. It's supporting the Davidic line. You want to know what Shaul's like. You want to know what that whole group is like. Well, just look at this story. This is what Binyamin is. Right? That's the argument. And the story does overlap with elements of Shaul's career. First of all, Gibeah, which is the city where the atrocity is going to take place, is also Shaul's hometown. That's the hometown of Shaul HaMelech. They will cut up a body and send it around the country as a message to rally people to war against Binyamin. Well, take a look on your sheet at source number 7. From Shaul's time, when Shaul is trying to rally the Jews to go to war, Vayikach tzemed bakar, he took a pair of cattle, Vayinatcheyu, and he cut it up, Vayishalach b'chol gvul Yisrael b'yad ha-malachim, and he sent it with messengers all around Israel, Leimor asher einenu yotzei achari Shaul, saying, anyone who doesn't follow Shaul, v'achar Shmuel, and who doesn't follow Shmuel, ko ye'asel livkaro, this shall be done to his cattle, and they said, okay, we'll go to war. But it's this act of cutting it into pieces and sending it around to rally the nation, not to mention, yes, the Jews will go to war against Yavesh Gilad in this story, and Shaul saved Yavesh Gilad from Ammon. So that it's like you're setting it up in opposition to the deeds of
Shaul.
You have a good period of time, but not a lot.
Like his father would have remembered.
His father would have remembered this. Yeah. Well, it depends. No, I shouldn't say that. It depends on when this story happened. If you take the Abarbanel Radak approach, then Shaul's father would know this story. If you take the approach of basically everybody else, centuries have passed. So it all depends on where you place the story. Right? Because remember, Shmuel lives for 52 years. Right? And Shmuel is going to come on the scene in the beginning of the book of Shmuel. Right? After Eli has been a leader for some period of time. A little bit unclear to me what that period of time is. I'd have to look. But fundamentally, Shmuel lives long enough to coronate Shaul, to see Shaul's reign fall apart, and to coronate David.
But still, this is such a terrible story that I'm sure if people talked about it.
Oh yeah, no, you don't forget this story.
Don't forget it. So his
that's for sure.
Especially if you got
right. Well, Yehezkel Kaufman looks at this idea that it's a polemic against Shaul's house, and he says, I'm sorry, that makes no sense. He says, even though we just built it up, right, he says, it doesn't make any sense. Take a look at source number 8, where I thought it was worth retyping it and translating it, because I liked what he had to say with it. He says, first of all, Hadeasha Sipur Notzar Mitoch Ta'amolet Ziva'ah. I learned a new term. Shal Beit David Neged Beit Shaul. Ta'amolet, literally, what's amal?
Work.
Ta'amolet is something that you contrive, that you work to produce. Ziva'ah is an atrocity, something that makes people cry out. Ta'amolet Ziva'ah is a propaganda of atrocity. It says, that terrible things have been done, like in wartime when you say about the enemy, the enemy is doing this, the enemy is doing that, that kind of thing. So he says, the view that this story was created as a sort of propaganda of atrocity created by the house of David against Beit Shaul, Shaul's household, eina ela hamtza'a b'teila utluya al belima. He says, this is an empty creation, this idea based on nothing. He said, if you really had that kind of propaganda going, he says, first of all, then why is it that in the time of David and Shaul, and later, nobody actually says, remember what happened in Givah? Right? There isn't a single mention of it. That means it was a very bad propaganda piece, if that's what it was. He says, there is none. Shaul, further, hudumut tragit. Shaul is a tragic figure. Yes, that's how you write tragic. Avol mele ahod va'atzilut. However, he is full of glory and nobility, meaning he's constantly presented as a king. Le David hu Mashiach Hashem ad arega ha'acharon. David calls him, to the last minute, the anointed one of God. He always treats Shaul with honor, not the way you would treat someone who was meant to evoke the images of this story. He says further, we don't find anyone say anything negative about Binyamin other than this story. Meaning, as Tanakh continues, no one says, yeah, Binyamin, they're terrible people. You would expect this would be part of a chain of propaganda. Right? Even if you're going to say, well, it wasn't mentioned in the time of Shaul and David, because maybe somebody later, right? You have to remember, the Bible critics are not, they feel no allegiance to the idea that this is written by a prophet with a message, with a divine inspiration or message from God or whatever. So they'll say maybe it was made up later on. But Kaufman, who is from their school, says, then you should see some kind of trail. There should be other elements of propaganda against Binyamin. And there aren't.
Meaning that the story is not true?
Their allegation is that the story is not true. The scholars are arguing, or built from some kernel and then expanded. Correct. This story that we're about to read.
Isn't it such a huge happening that there is no evidence of it anywhere?
You won't find evidence.
You're saying the story is not true, or that it's not meant to be propaganda?
Hang on. The critics are claiming the story is not true. The critics are making the claim the story is not true, or based on a kernel and then built up. Kaufman is defending the story, and he's saying it doesn't make sense as propaganda. I'm going to, in the interest of time, because I see that we're getting to the end, I want to sum up what he's doing. He says, first of all, if this were intended as propaganda, we should have seen it referenced later on. Number one. Number two, Shaul never has this story held against him, even though he's from Givah, he's the target. Number three, he says, it's not as though you find any sort of other propaganda against Binyamin anywhere in Tanakh. And even in this story, he continues to say, Binyamin is portrayed in a sympathetic way, not the people of Givah. But Binyamin is a brother. They talk about how we can save the tribe. Like they're not acting like they want to destroy them. And he says, you don't find any reference to enmity. And in fact, when the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom split, Yehuda in the south, right? Who is it who leads the north? Not Binyamin. It's Ephraim. Binyamin sticks with Yehuda. Yehuda and Binyamin are the two tribes. Right? You talk about the 10 lost tribes, there's the two who stayed, and there's Levi mixed in, and maybe some Shimon. But it's Yehuda and Binyamin who stay together. So that's the point that Kaufman is trying to make, is it's a fancy it's a fanciful argument. It's an interesting idea that they're trying to present when they make the argument that that this is somehow a polemic against Shaul. But it sounds good when you start and you see the commonalities between the stories, but then you start thinking about it logically and you realize this doesn't hold water at all. And that's the point that he wants to make.
He implies that this did happen.
Yeah, I mean, I want to leave out Kaufman's general beliefs about Tanakh because that's really a longer discussion. But the story does. It sounds like he believes it, and I certainly think yes. The story, as terrible as it is, I don't think you make up a story like this.
I'm sure.
No one would ever want to tell a story like this about themselves.
You wouldn't put it in Tanakh.
Yeah. I mean, you don't invent stories like this. You really don't. You'll see.
Just like Trump.
I want to avoid him. The last introduction we're going to have to do, which will have to be our start next time, is going to be. I keep using the word Pilegesh. Sorry. Yes. Pilegesh is a concubine. And so we have to first understand what in the world is that in Judaism. So we'll start with that, and then we'll start on the story, God willing, next week.